Well, a warm good afternoon to everyone. It's our first time, or my first time, in Phoenix for services. We've been down here to visit friends a few times. My wife has been here for church a couple times, so it is nice to be here. I want to say hi to those that we've known for years. Nice to see the Hoyers again, several others, Jerry and Karen. It's good to be in a place where I've heard so much about. And the Elliots, of course, are now coming up to our neck of the woods. We want to thank you for allowing them to come up. They'll be a great blessing to the Northwest, and I think they will enjoy their time there very much, and they'll be greatly appreciated. We had a wonderful winter, almost no rain except for a few downpours, somewhat like what you get, I understand, in maybe early summer, middle of the summer. And the last few weeks, it's been 60s and sunny. Had to mow my lawn the day before yesterday before we left. Mr. Elliott and I were out in Cincinnati last week. We actually had it the week before last, and they had about 12 inches of snow on the ground. We arrived on Sunday. It was about 20 degrees. By Monday morning, it was 9 below zero. And I called my wife up. She said, you know, the lawn needs mowing. You better get back here and mow the lawn. The sun's out. The blossoms are out. So I do hope if we ever do decide to move the central office, it'll be moved to the Northwest. But we will see. You may have heard a few things about Washington State. Just let me tell you that all you hear is not 100% accurate. It is dominated by a very severe metropolitan mentality in the Seattle area. That does not reflect the majority of the people that live in other parts of the state. We are noted for things along the, let's just say, the edge of socialism, things like assisted suicide, the first state to pass gay marriage laws. We also have things now, like you may have heard of this grass that people smoke or roll up called pot. We, along with Colorado, have led the nation in some of those pioneering things. It truly is sort of an interesting place to live because it's like every day, whatever crazy thing has been done in the past, something crazier happens. For instance, 2 years ago, the mayor of Seattle, I think it was Nichols, they changed them quite often. He decided that people needed to learn to ride bikes. So he had the police cordon off certain housing areas during the week, and people were driving home, and all of a sudden they couldn't drive home because their street had been declared a car-free zone for 3 days. So people carrying groceries and, you know, trying to get back and forth either had to find some place to park, which was almost impossible. Downtown parking in Seattle is $8 an hour. It can cost you more to park than to go to dinner sometimes. And there was enough, let's say, complaints raised after that was done 3 or 4 times, that the next idea was to cordon off parking spaces downtown as picnic areas for homeless people. I saw this with my eye. I was down there trying to find one of these $8 an hour places to park, and there's these homeless people with their blankets sitting in one of the parking lots. The problem was they're on the street, and there's cars going by at 40 miles an hour, and every now and then one of the homeless people would get bumped by one of the cars, so that didn't work well either. But just suffice it to say that nothing shocks us, and we do know that someday Jesus Christ is going to return, going to solve a lot of the issues. But the story of mankind fumbling around trying to govern himself and trying to figure out what is best. Oh, the latest one. About a month ago, it became the law in Seattle. They've always done this, at least as they said they were going to. But they literally go through everybody's garbage, and if you have, it used to be if you had recyclables in your garbage, you were fined $50. Now, these guys that are going through your garbage are making about $120,000 a year as garbage men. But now, if you have garbage in there that should be in a compost, they have like 4 different garbage cans. You know, you got plastic, you got paper, you got garbage, and you've got your compostable garbage. So now they go through your garbage, and if you have, you know what compostable garbage is? I mean, it doesn't smell good. It's ugly. It's squishy. It's, you know, various colors and fumes. And if you have that in your regular garbage, then you get fined $50 or $100. So just be forewarned that, you know, whatever you hear about Seattle, it's probably true. And it's sad because it is such a gorgeous city. I mean, with the ocean, with the Puget Sound, with the mountains in the back, and it's just about the most gorgeous setting. When they call it the Emerald City, they truly are saying with some accuracy what it is. But it is also, I think, just a challenge every day trying to figure out, you know, what those powers that be are going to do. So you can understand why perhaps many of them come down here for the winter months. Having said that, I want to ask you a question today, and that is, what is the most harmful drug you can become addicted to? Most of you are familiar with harmful drugs. At least you've heard about them in the news, hopefully. Pot, of course, becomes very addictive. My wife works with people with disabilities. It's almost impossible in her business to find anyone under 50 anymore that has got a list of drugs they've been addicted to. I have a niece, unfortunately, and some other relatives terribly addicted to it's the one that's gotten really cheap. Not cocaine. It's the other one that's really bad. Heroin. It's like $10 a shot now on the streets. Used to be hundreds. And, of course, our family is struggling, and some of my extended family is struggling with that. But there's a drug each one of you may have already had experience with that's just as dangerous, and I want to talk about that drug today. In fact, I brought some. If you can see this, this drug is called hopium. Hopium. I hope you can see that. Now, hopium is doing something you know is wrong, but you hope it's going to turn out okay anyway. Anybody ever do that? I think we all have. It can be a deadly habit to get into. I want to go through the example of someone today who lost everything he had because he was addicted to hopium. He was wealthy. He had a large family. He had a tremendous future, and he lost it all because of his addiction to hopium. His story begins in Genesis chapter 11. Let's go back there. I realize the theme of the week is where your heart is, or where your treasure is, your heart will be also. In this case, I want to at least talk about this concept that this drug could destroy the real treasure you ought to have. In Genesis chapter 11, in verse 10, this is the genealogy of Shem. Now, the descendants of Shem are called Semites. It is not just the descendants of Eber, who are the Hebrews, but the descendants of Shem are called Semites. When we talk about anti-Semitic, it actually is a much larger number of people than what we normally interpret that as. When he was 100 years old, he began Arphaxad 2 years after the flood. And we have a lineage here. Lineages are very important to God. His concern with family heritage, I think, is something that we need to think about from time to time. And down in verse 27, this is the genealogy of Terah. Terah begat Abram, Nahor, and Haran. So he had three sons. One of them, Haran, the youngest of the three, begat Lot. Haran died before his father. Must have had some disease of some kind. Something happened to him. Haran died before his father in his native land in Ur of the Chaldees. Now, Ur was a city on the Euphrates River, quite a bit north of what we call modern-day Baghdad, but it was a land where these men lived. And so this man, Lot, became fatherless, somewhat of an orphan, apparently at a fairly young age. Now, the word Lot, interesting, means keep in check, but let's continue on over to Genesis chapter 12. Verse 1 said, "The Lord had said to Abram, 'Get out of your country, from your family, from your father's house, to a land that I will show you. I will make you a great nation, and I will bless you. I will make your name great, and you shall be a blessing. I will bless those who bless you, and I will curse him who curses you. And you, all the families of the earth, will be blessed.'" And we've seen that even in our time, although those blessings are certainly rapidly being removed as we have turned away from God. Now, if you continue studying the story of Abraham, which we don't have time to do today, the more he obeyed, the more God enlarged this blessing. To begin with, he could just inherit the land he could see. Well, how far can you see with the naked eye? About 8 miles each direction if the land is flat. The next time, it's extended all the way to the rivers, the Nile, Euphrates, and after that, it includes the entire earth. So as he obeyed, his blessing increased. But in this case, God simply appearing to him when he's in Ur of the Chaldees, and he's telling him to get out of Dodge. This part of the world is going to be going through turmoil. It was the center of moon worship, the moon worship that today comes down to us in the form of Mohammedism or the Muslim religion. You notice they've got a little crescent moon on top of all of their mosques. It's very easy in history to document that it goes back to the moon religion of the Ur of the Chaldees of the Babylonian era. In fact, Allah is actually the moon god of Arabia. It's simply moon worship. Of course, the challenge is we've been to the moon, and it's not a god. It's a rock, or a rock and some dust. But that's a sidelight. You can study that on your own at some point. There's a book called God Has 99 Names that covers it pretty carefully. It's an excellent book if you'd like to get some reference to it. Let's go to Genesis chapter 13 and verse 1. Abram went up from Egypt, he and his wife and all that he had, and Lot with him to the south. Now, Abram was very rich in livestock, silver, and in gold. He had all of these physical things to buy whatever he wanted to buy in Egypt or wherever else he traveled. He went as far on his journey from the south as Bethel, house of God's what Bethel means, a place which later where they would set the tabernacle up under Joshua when they crossed into the promised land, to the place where his tent had been at the beginning between Bethel and Ai. That's the area we call Shechem, or where Jacob's well is today. To the place of the altar which he had made there at first, and there Abram called on the name of the Lord. Now notice, Lot also went with Abram. He had flocks and herds and tents. So Lot apparently had inherited everything his father had owned. So you have these three brothers, they're all very wealthy, one of them dies, and the wealth of the younger brother goes to his son Lot, who then leaves and goes with Uncle Abraham off to a different country, the land that God showed him to go. So we have these two separate groups of sheep, goats, you know, donkeys, whatever else they might have. They may have had some wagons that were full of, you know, physical possessions, perhaps the beautiful silks or the linens, the clothing of that time, or the silver and gold possessions. And they also would have had the very heavy rugs that they would roll onto the desert as they put their tents up, and those heavy rugs became the floor of the place where they lived. So Lot had his own flocks, herds, and tents. Notice the land was not able to support them that they might dwell together, for their possessions were so great they could not dwell together. So in short, the grass was in short supply. There wasn't enough grass. They had no irrigation then, but there were too many animals to feed and not enough food for them. It says their herdsmen strove together. There was strife between the herdsmen of Abram's livestock and the herdsmen of Lot's livestock. The Canaanites and the Perizzites then dwelled in the land. So there were other people around, and he couldn't just spread out in any direction he wanted to go. There were borders that they couldn't cross with their flocks and their herds. So Abram said to Lot, "Let there be no strife between me and you." He was a peacemaker, a very gentle man apparently. "Between my herdsmen and your herdsmen, for we are brethren. Is not the whole land before you? Please separate from me. If you take the left, then I'll go to the right. If you go to the right, then I will go to the left." So Abram offered Lot his choice. "Whatever area you want to go, I will go the other direction." So Lot lifted up his eyes and saw all the plain of Jordan, that it was well watered everywhere, before the Lord had destroyed Sodom and Gomorrah. That entire southern one-third of the Dead Sea today is very likely the area that was called the plain, and apparently it was well watered. It would have been somewhat low. Some of the tradition says it was actually lowered down to the present level because of the destruction of Sodom and Gomorrah, and we'll probably have to have the answer to that after Christ returns. But the Bible does say that that plain, which was a very broad plain, was verdant, it was green, it was productive, and they were able then to have plenty of grass and food for their animals. So Lot chose for himself the plain of Jordan, and Lot journeyed east, and they separated from each other. Abraham or Abram then dwelt in the land of Canaan. Lot dwelt in the cities of the plain and pitched his tent even as far as Sodom. So Lot chose the well-watered plain. Unfortunately, he chose the city. He chose the attraction of what looked like an perhaps exciting life. Doesn't say much about Lot's wife here, because perhaps Lot actually found his wife in Sodom. But he went towards Sodom, not just near it. He wanted to be close, but he doesn't want to actually be a part of Sodom at this point. Now, in my ministry over the past, 35 years, however long it's been, for better or for worse, I think for worse, but at least for whatever reason, I've had to deal with a number of what we call predators. Predators are people without a conscience who prey on innocent people. And unfortunately, they often target churches. Sometimes they wiggle their way into the ministry. Oftentimes we hear about them as coaches or as teachers. In the late 1990s, 96, 97, I realized that I had been outgunned by these guys, so I began to do a lot of research. I read the book Without Conscience by Dr. Robert Hare, who is probably the preeminent authority on predators and psychopaths in the world. I called and talked to him. I've been not in regular contact, but I've read his subsequent books and also others that are along that line. Now, I'm in no way a qualified psychiatrist or psychologist, don't think that. But I'll tell you two things I have learned through study and through observation that if you get nothing else today, please write these down. There are two tools that predators use to prey on their victims. These are the same tools that Satan the devil uses to prey on you. The first tool, find out what your victim wants and promise it to them. You don't have to deliver anything. All the predator has to do is talk to his potential victim, whether it's a young child at the playground, whether it's a single lady at home, whoever it might be. Find out what they really want, what makes them tick inside, and then promise it to them. You don't have to give it to them. You just have to promise it. Make them think you're going to give them this, whatever it is they want. The second tool is called grooming. Make them comfortable around you. That is what Satan is always trying to do to us. He's trying to get us comfortable with his philosophy and his ideas. For some reason, Sodom offered something that Lot wanted. He could have pitched his tent on the western side of the plain, but he didn't. He pitched it on the eastern side of the plain, right next to Sodom. So he thought he could come close. He knew there was something there that he wanted, and he began to get groomed. He began to think, well, it's okay, you know, it's bad, but it's okay, it's sort of normal. If you want an example of that, I'm sure you're familiar with 40 years ago, the very idea of homosexuality was repugnant to the average American. We all knew it was wrong and evil. But they have blasted you in the face, in the ears, everywhere you go for the past 30 years on TV and entertainment. And we have all, as a society, been groomed by that group to accept not only their lifestyle, but now basically our national religion is that we must endorse it or else. In fact, up in the state in which we live, which is a gorgeous, beautiful state, there was a bill which was proposed last year. Thankfully, it did not pass the state legislature, but the bill is going to come up again, and it basically says any nonprofit group that rents a publicly owned building, which we do, we rent schools to meet in, must have a statement in their nonprofit papers that say they endorse gay marriage, that they do not in any way refused services to, which of course in our case would be doing wedding ceremonies, to those who are of that ilk. If that's the case, we will lose our meeting halls just because of that one bill being passed. We'll have to find private or other buildings to meet in. So these things are being forced upon us as state religion, but it's only after 30 years of grooming. And normally predators will get closer and closer and closer and start maybe some physical contact with their potential victims. And that's exactly what Lot did. He didn't realize that was what was happening to him, but he pitched his tent towards Sodom and began to be used to having all that evil around him. It says in verse 13, the men of Sodom were exceedingly wicked and sinful against the Lord. Doesn't say that Lot left them. There's a scripture in the New Testament that said he was vexed. Who knows what that means, other than he was frustrated and he almost lost his life. But he allowed himself to be close to be every day near and interacting with these people who were exceedingly wicked and sinful against the Lord. And that wall that he had built up, or should have built up, knowing good from evil, began to be torn down. Let's drop down a little bit farther to continue in the story, because Lot certainly became very close to it. Let's go over to Genesis chapter 18, beginning in verse 16. Genesis chapter 18. In the interceding chapters, we have stories about Sarah and Isaac, promises to Abraham. In Genesis chapter 18, we have the story here of God coming down to warn Abraham about Sodom. Verse 17 says, the Lord said, shall I hide from Abraham what I am doing? Since Abraham shall surely become a great and mighty nation, God had changed his name from Abram to Abraham, and had promised him to become great in the earth. All the nations of the earth shall be blessed in him. We've seen that both with the birth of Jesus Christ and the extension of the blessings of Abraham to the nations of Israel, and then, of course, to all the earth in the last 2.5 centuries. All the nations of the earth shall be blessed in him, for I have known him, in order that he may command his children and his household after him, that they may keep the way of the Lord to do righteousness and justice. Notice that the Lord may bring to Abraham all that he has spoken to him. But the Lord said, because the outcry against Sodom and Gomorrah is great, and because their sin is very grave, I will go down now and see whether they have done altogether according to the outcry against it that it has done to me or come to me, and if not, I will know it. Interesting that in the Bible, homosexuality is actually condemned 11 times, more than murder and more than stealing. I want to go back to a couple New Testament. Actually, let's go over first to Proverbs chapter 12 and verse 1. Let's go over to a couple of Proverbs here before we come back to our story. Proverbs chapter 12, let's begin in verse 15. Who knows how many years Lot had pitched his tent toward Sodom? By the time we find him here in chapter 18, as we'll see, he's very familiar. He's in the gate, which means he was a city leader, or at least wise, respected for his opinion and judgment. In Proverbs chapter 12 and verse 15, it says, the way of a fool is right in his own eyes, but he who heeds counsel is wise. A fool's wrath is known at once, but a prudent man covers shame. So the way of a fool is right in his own eyes. It's easy to deceive yourself. It's easy for the drug of hopium, doing something you know that's wrong, but hoping it'll turn out right, how that can afflict every one of us. Over in verse 26 of the same chapter, the righteous should choose his friends carefully. Something we often mention at summer camp during our Bible studies and some of the Christian living classes that we cover at summer camp every year. The righteous should choose his friends carefully, because what you are around on a daily basis, you tend to think is normal, and eventually you begin to agree with. For the way of the wicked leads them astray. Let's also go over to James chapter 4 and verse 4. James chapter 4 and verse 4. Lot made friends with the people of Sodom and Gomorrah. Lot apparently got his wife in Sodom or Gomorrah. Lot had daughters, and Lot had sons-in-law that were married to him in Sodom and Gomorrah, married to his daughters. James chapter 4 and verse 4 says, adulterers and adulteresses, do you not know that friendship with the world is enmity with God? You know, what is friendship with the world? Unfortunately, I think we've all been guilty of it, one form or another. What passes now for entertainment in movies 20, 30 years ago would have been called hardcore pornography. Some of the vile messages that are blasted on the airwaves, we sort of get used to. I think so many people I know, especially just people that have families with children, have just turned away from even having a television, or if nothing else, at least not having cable or satellite dishes, but just perhaps getting these education channels. Even my son with our three granddaughters has gotten rid of his cable TV and just has it's a Hulu or something. I'm not sure exactly how they work. We've got one of these little Amazon things that we can get YouTube stuff on. I do like watching war movies on Amazon. You know, my wife doesn't like me watching so many war movies, but you know, it's all history, so it's history. So years ago, she got a little upset with me and said, you know, all you're doing is reading all these war books all the time. You know, shouldn't you have some variety in your life? So I came back with a new set of books, and she asked what it was. I said, well, this is about the Revolutionary War. She said, well, I thought you were going to quit doing that. I said, well, this is a different war. You know, this is not World War II. This is the Revolutionary War I'm studying about now. So you can't have a little bit of variety in your war history, but that's a sidelight. I think the point is that so many people that want to obey God are realizing now that the messages that are sent out, even in the commercials, for someone that likes to watch football, and I really appreciate the fact that nobody has mentioned the last play of the Super Bowl since I've been here. That's very, very nice of you not to mention that. But the commercials. It's hard to even watch sports anymore, a game you want to see, because the commercials are so full of vile stuff. But we can become inured to it. We can become friends with it, just like Lot did. The last part of this verse says, "Whoever therefore wants to be a friend of the world makes himself an enemy of God." Lot tried to have it both ways. He tried to be a friend of the people in Sodom and Gomorrah, and yet he became virtually an enemy of God, not even knowing he was going through that process. Let's go back now to 2 Corinthians chapter 6 and verse 11. 2 Corinthians 6 and verse 11. Kind of continue on the same vent, same theme. It says, "O Corinthians, we have spoken openly to you, for our heart is wide open. You are not restricted by us, but you are restricted by your own affections." See, their own emotions. They had their own form of hopium, I would say. "In return for the same, I speak to you as children, you also be open. Do not be unequally yoked together with unbelievers. For what fellowship has righteousness with lawlessness?" Sodom was a land of lawlessness. There were no commandments of God being carried out. In fact, they were being flaunted in the open. It was a land of lawlessness. What communion has light with darkness? Or what accord has Christ with Belial? What part has a believer with an unbeliever? And he finally says in verse 16, "What agreement has a temple of God with idols?" Because indeed, that type of behavior in Sodom was idolatry, just in a very, I guess, obvious form. Now let's go back to Genesis chapter 18. Abraham did not understand. This is kind of an odd observation in Genesis 18, that Abraham didn't understand how wicked Sodom was. He knew it was a city. He knew it was down there in the green, well-watered plain. Perhaps he had heard, you know, some reports about how bad things were and about how evil they were. So verse 22, "The men turned away from there," chapter 18, verse 22 of Genesis, "they went towards Sodom. But Abraham stood before the Lord. Abraham came near and said, 'Well, would you also destroy the righteous with the wicked? Suppose there were 50 righteous within the city.'" He thought there might be 50. He didn't know just how thoroughly wicked Sodom had become. He said, "You're going to slay the righteous with the evil?" Verse 25, "Far be it from you to do such a thing as this, to slay the righteous with the wicked, so the righteous should be as the wicked. Far be it from you." So the Lord said in verse 26, "If I find in Sodom 50 righteous within the city, I will spare all that place for their sakes." And you are familiar with the story. He goes down to 45 and then 30 and finally 10. Maybe Abraham's thinking, you know, last I heard there weren't really very many righteous people there, so let's kind of get this number down a little bit. Maybe I think the number 10, and I'll tell you why I believe you said 10. This is my opinion from what I can discern from the scriptures. You would have Lot and his wife. Lot apparently had four daughters. Two of them were married. So you've got eight. But maybe he thought the other two were also married or they were betrothed. So in Lot's family, there would have been 10 people. And so Abraham finally says, "Okay, God, what if we only have these 10? Can you spare the city or, you know, spare it for their sake, get them out?" So my guess is that Abraham is thinking that there are 10 people in Lot's family that would be able to be saved. So he said in verse 32, "Let not the Lord be angry, but I'll speak once. Suppose 10 should be found there." And he said, "I will not destroy it for the sake of 10. So 10 people would have saved a city. There were not 10 that were saved. But it does beg the question, what is the number today? How many righteous people do there have to be left in this country before God says, "I'm sorry, Leviticus 19 says you'll be spewed off the land because of what you're doing"? I don't know what the number is. What is the number that would save our country from destruction? What's the minimum number of righteous people? I don't know what it is. I know God knows what it is, and perhaps someday we will find out. No doubt Abraham was very concerned about what his nephew was doing. He may have agonized over it a great deal. In chapter 19, the two angels came to Sodom in the evening, and Lot was sitting in the gate of Sodom. Normally there were chairs in the gates, and they were for the city judges, for those who were respected, for doing business deals. So it does seem to indicate that he had grown to a certain level of prominence in the city of Sodom. At least he was recognized. When Lot saw them, he rose to meet them. So he recognized who they were. He knew they were angels or messengers from God, whom Abraham had worshipped and whom he had learned about worshipping from Abraham. He bowed himself with his face towards the ground, and he said, "Hear now, my lords, please turn into your servant's house and spend the night and wash your feet that you may rise early and go on your way." They said, "No, we'll spend the night here in the open." And oftentimes in the Middle East, the first invitation is always refused, and then there's kind of a negotiating thing that goes on. The same in the when you buy and sell in the various bazaars and places in that part of the world, which sort of takes a little bit of education to be able to do to get a decent price. But he insisted strongly, so they turned into him and entered his house, and he made them a feast and baked unleavened bread, and they ate. So just one indication, the only one we have, that likely this occurred during the days of unleavened bread. Now before they lay down, the men of the city, the men of Sodom, both old and young, all the people from every quarter, this was not a small group, this was hundreds, perhaps thousands, surrounded the house. And they called to Lot and said to him, "Where are the men who came to you tonight? Bring them out to us, that we may know them carnally." So Lot went out to them through the doorway and shut the door behind him. He went out onto the porch to talk to them. Notice it says, "Please, my brethren." He came to the place where he called them brethren. He called them basically his brothers or his friends. So he must have known them well. He must have had a relationship with them. Whatever comfort level that he may not have had in the past with these very wicked and evil people, he was now comfortable being around them. Satan's goal of grooming took its toll on Lot. He said, "Well, I have two daughters who have not known a man." This is obviously a very vile thing for most of us to contemplate. Notice, he has two daughters that have not known a man. He also has two daughters that are married. So when I went to school, 2 and 2 was 4. I know today's modern math, it's sort of in the spectrum of, you know, 4 to whatever, or the concept of 4 or something. But, you know, years ago, 2 and 2 was 4. So Lot has two daughters who are not married. He has two that are married. So he has 4 daughters. So the angel says to these, "Well, I have 2 daughters who are not married. They've never known man." Maybe he knew they would reject the offer, so perhaps he wasn't placing his daughters in jeopardy. Who knows exactly what was going on. But anyway, they said, "Stand back. This one came in here to stay, and he keeps acting as a judge." So in verse 9, it says he keeps acting as a judge. This was not the first time Lot had had a conversation with them that was of a judgmental nature. Perhaps he had talked to them and said, "You know, what you're doing is wrong. You really need to, you know." Perhaps he was a preacher of righteousness of some kind. All it says is that this one came in here to stay, and now he keeps acting as a judge. He's been a guest, but now he's been acting like a judge. "Now we will deal worse with you than with them." So they obviously said they were going to kill him. So they pressed hard against the man Lot. He came near to break down the door, but the men inside reached out and pulled him in. Verse 11, they struck all the men outside with blindness. And the men said to Lot, "Have you any more else here?" He said, "Well, your sons and your daughters, and whomever you have in this city, take them out of this place. We will destroy this place because the outcry against them has grown great before the face of the Lord, and the Lord has sent us to destroy it." So Lot went out, spoke to his sons-in-law who had married his daughters, and said, "Get up out of this place, for the Lord will destroy this city." But his sons-in-law seemed to him to be joking. So obviously, his sons-in-law were not followers of God. They were, for all intents and purposes, men of Sodom, men of Gomorrah. Doesn't say they were from anywhere else. And they thought he was joking. They had no faith at all in God's warning. When the morning dawned, the angels urged Lot to hurry, saying, "Arise, take your wife and your 2 daughters who are here, lest you be consumed in the punishment of the city." So the angels knew there weren't 10. They were only going to save Lot and his wife and his 2 daughters, 4 people. While he lingered, Something in Sodom was what he wanted. Remember the first step a predator will use? The first tool is to find out what a person wants and promise it to them. And there was something there. It may have been his other two daughters. It may have been his sons-in-law. Doesn't say grandchildren, but if there were grandchildren there, they would have been a strong reason to linger. But the men, the angels, took hold of his hand and the hands of his daughters, and the Lord being merciful, they brought him out and set him outside the city. So they supernaturally rescued him, his wife, and the two daughters who were unmarried. Escape for your life. Do not look behind you or stay anywhere in the plain. Escape to the mountains, lest you be destroyed. And verse 18 tells us that hopium had had its effect. A person that is drunk on a drug no longer can think logically. I'm not going to ask for a show of hands if anybody's had relatives or had experience with people who were addicts. There comes a point when emotion and illogic takes over that person's life. The same happens in hopium as it does with cocaine, with methamphetamines, and with other mind-altering drugs. Lot said to them, "Please, no, no, my lords. Don't kill these evil people. Indeed, now your servant has found favor in your sight, and you have increased your mercy by which you have shown me by saving my life. But I cannot escape to the mountains, lest some evil overtake me and die." In other words, he's feeling sorry for himself. He's feeling sorry. Why? He lost everything. He didn't take any herds. He didn't take any flocks. He didn't take any of his sheep. He didn't take any of his wealth. He didn't take most of his family. He just left with the shirt on his back and two of his unmarried daughters. Who knows exactly how much family, how much wealth, how much of everything in his life he lost because Lot was drunk on the drug hopium. He did something he knew wasn't quite right. He pitched his tent towards Sodom, hoping it would turn out okay. But friendship with the world is not friendship at all. It's a facade. Because you see, friendship with any predator is not real friendship. It's simply a tool for that predator to get his way. The predator in this case is Satan the devil, and he wants each one of us to cast our tent towards Sodom because he knows what the result will be. Verse 26 says, Lot's wife looked back behind him, and she became a pillar of salt. My guess is that he met her and married her in Sodom. That would seem to be the logical conclusion. If for somehow he had her as a wife before he went to Sodom, there's no record of that. But if he did, then she was completely seduced by that culture, and she really wanted the high life, the fancy clothes, the dances, whatever they offered there in this city of the plain, she wanted, and she simply was not able to turn away from it. So she became a pillar of salt. You go to that part of the world, there must be 10 pillars of salt that are labeled Lot's wife. If it was a pillar of salt, like we understand salt, it would have been washed away years ago. But it's kind of like pieces of the cross going through Europe. There's enough pieces of the cross in churches in Europe to build several massive skyscrapers. But obviously, those relics are long gone from time. But Lot's wife looked back. We don't know too much else about her. Apparently, she felt she could marry Satan's world, stay in Satan's world, and not be affected. She was wrong. And she was taken by God because perhaps she was a pull that pulled Lot the wrong way. Lot went to Sodom, a very wealthy man. He had flocks, he had possessions. He had children that were born, at least four daughters. He had sons-in-law. Because of his addiction to hopium, he came out with nothing except two of the daughters. No flocks, no wife. Let's go back to Mark chapter 9 and verse 42. One of the things we teach campers every year, and you'll have to forgive me for talking about summer camp. I'm always recruiting youth to come to Northwest Camp, which I think is the most incredible piece of real estate I've ever seen for a summer camp. It is stunningly gorgeous. But tomorrow is Sunday, March 8th, I believe, and that's the day our web page is open. So my life will be chaos for the next 2 to 3 months. With campers applying, staff applying, scholarships, calls about transportation, on and on it goes. And just before we left, in fact, on Friday night late, before we were able to actually Thursday night late before we got on the plane Friday to come here, I finally was able to finish all of the Christian living classes that will be used in all of the camps during this coming year. And that's, as far as I'm concerned, the most important thing I do every year is I write all the, edit and put together all the Christian living classes used in all the camps for all the campers and all the staff. And Mr. Newtzman's let me do that, and we have help from the other camp directors, of course, and I edit it and put things together in formats that match. But since we've done that, we have a package, we have a theme, we have daily themes. We have a Christian living class given in the morning, and every activity, those lessons are illustrated and talked about. And the campers do their memory scriptures as they're going back and forth between their activities. And we also even have the campfire story at night illustrating that theme or that lesson of the day. So when the campers leave, they have a complete package of scriptures, of lessons, and a theme that hopefully will carry them throughout, certainly the next year, but perhaps throughout their life. And at the feast, we always do some reviewing at the youth Bible study at the feast. It's amazing how many of the scriptures and the themes the campers can all remember. So it is having a good effect, and certainly it's a wonderful thing to be able to do. I wish we would have had this same type of camp all during the history of God's church, rather than perhaps larger camps focused more on activities. But thankfully, I believe we're doing a lot of good now with the summer camps that we have and with really youth programs overall. And I would like to honestly, while I'm here, don't want to forget thanking Randy and Kay Schreiber for their help with this youth program that I'm sort of overseeing it as being part of, I mean, my committee on the council sort of oversees it. We haven't had to oversee much because they've done such a fabulous job. And I just really want to thank them for all they've done and any of you that have had a part in it. Now, having said all of that, let's go to Mark chapter 9 and verse 42. Jesus Christ said, "Whoever causes one of these little ones who believe in me to stumble, it would be better for him if a millstone were hung around his neck and he were thrown into the sea." So having a millstone and drowning is better than causing a little one to stumble. "If your hand causes you to sin, cut it off. It's better for you to enter into life maimed rather than having two hands and go into Gehenna fire, hell, into fire that shall never be quenched." So he's saying whatever causes the offense, whatever causes hopium to grow, whether it's grooming, becoming familiar, whether it's having something you want that you really shouldn't want, that you're attracted to, whatever it is, cut it off. Verse 45, "If your foot causes you to sin, cut it off. It's better for you to enter into life lame, there rather than having 2 feet be cast into the grave." And of course it says the worm dies not, which simply means the bodies are consumed. Verse 47, "If your eyes cause you to sin, pluck it out. It's better to enter the kingdom of God with one eye rather than having 2 eyes and be cast into hellfire." Verse 49 says, "Everyone will be seasoned with fire, and every sacrifice will be seasoned with salt." He's saying every one of us will have these challenges. Everyone will be tempted to pitch his tent toward Sodom. Everyone will be tempted to drink a lot of hopium. Everyone will be seasoned with fire. Our challenge is to make sure we recognize it and cut off that influence, cut off the foot or the eye or the hand that might lead us down that path. Salt is good, but if the salt loses its flavor, how will you season it? Now, sodium chloride doesn't lose its flavor, but sodium fluoride's flavor can be contaminated by dirt, by things it shouldn't be contaminated with, vinegar. It's contaminated. Salt loses its savor when it is mixed with something that is not salt. And so that's what Satan wants us to do. He wants to mix our life with something that's not pure. And certainly those temptations are out there all around us. "Have salt," or purity, "in yourselves, and have peace with one another." That was an illustration of someone who didn't cut off the arm, leg, or foot, the eye. He got close, he became familiar, and he essentially lost everything that life offered him. Let's finish over in Luke chapter 12, beginning in verse 17. Luke chapter 12 and verse 17. This is about treasures, about somebody that had a lot of treasures. He spoke a certain parable to them, verse 16 of Luke chapter 12, saying, "The ground of a certain rich man yielded plentifully, and he thought within himself, saying, 'What shall I do, since I have no room to store my crops?' He said, 'Well, I'll do this. I'll pull down my barns and build greater ones, and I'll store all my crops and all my goods. And I will say to my soul, soul, you have many goods that you have stored up for many years. Take your ease, eat, drink, and be merry.'" We might say it's time for him to, you know, get his motor home and retire to the south. He had all the money he needed. He had it all put away in barns. But God said to him, "Fool, this night your soul will be required of you. Then whose will those things be which you have provided? So is he who lays up treasure for himself and is not rich towards God." Lot was rich towards God when he was living with Abraham, but his physical things became so much of a burden that he had to separate, and he pitched his tent towards Sodom. He became, for some reason, attracted to Sodom. He eventually became used to it. He knew what he knew. He did what he knew was wrong, but he somehow hoped it would turn out. And we've seen today that it turned out very, very poorly. Cost the life of many of his family members and cost him everything he had except for the shirt on his back. Notice it says in verse 22, he said to his disciples, "I say to you, do not worry about your life. Don't be attracted to Sodom. Don't let any predator offer you what you want, because what we really want is God's kingdom. We don't want anything less. Do not worry about your life, what you will eat, or about the body, what you will put on, because life is more than food, and the body is more than clothing." And then he talks about, consider the ravens and the birds and how God takes care of them. When he take care of us much more. Verse 37, "Blessed are those servants when the master, when he comes, will find watching. Assuredly, I say to you that he will gird himself and have them sit down to eat and will come and serve them." The important thing is that we must be watching. We must be doing what we know is right. We must resist any temptation to pitch our tent towards Sodom, or in our society, allow Sodom to pitch their tent in our house. There's a great reward coming, and Jesus Christ says he will someday sit down and eat with us. But we won't be eating any drug called hopium. What we'll be eating, the antidote to hopium, is truthium. And truthium is found in this book.